I'm Christopher Lydon with Arianna Huffington, Queen of Bloggers. Many say the leading edge of media trends. At the news site that teases you with trash to sell transformation, HuffingtonPost.com. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Arianna Huffington, on top of the media trend, is ever sleuthing for the political direction of things. Born in Greece, educated in England, she has veered right, then left in American politics. She is now on the left Democratic side of the populist stream. Her new book, Third World America, is a caution that might just be an invitation to a liberal sort of tea party. It was the occasion of our public conversation the other night at the Brattle Theater in Harvard Square.
Arianna Huffington and I are, I think, continuing a conversation. It began in 1988 with one of our first books about Picasso. We talked about it on WGBH television, and it's a pleasure to be continuing it. My first question is for the audience. I just want to throw it out there. How many people here would have paid $5 and filled the Brattle Theater to hear the publisher of the New York Times talk about his book? How about the president of CBS, whoever that is? NBC, ABC. Okay, we'll come back to that theme.
That's not fair. It depends on the book. They could have written a good book. First of all, it's great to be with you.
Pleasure.
I always love talking with you.
I do too.
And I love it when you write and you put it on the Huffington Post.
Thank you.
That's great.
Thank you. This is my publisher, after all.
You should do that more often. And also, I love this theater. I've never been here before, and it's just beautiful and sort of redolent of history. And it doesn't exactly feel like Third World America, but kind of could be, right? So one of the reasons I chose this title is because my favorite heroine in Greek mythology is Cassandra. Mm. You know, Cassandra told the Trojans, you may remember, not to let the Trojan horse in. Mm. And they didn't believe her. And they turned out to be very wrong and very dead. So the idea here is to sound the alarm, to say that we are in this trajectory, that we have still the time to turn around, but if we don't course correct, basically the middle class is crumbling. Instead of upward mobility, we have downward mobility. The polls that came out last week showed that two-thirds of the American people now believe that their children are not going to do as well as they're doing. I'm sure you all know kids graduating from college who can't get jobs, people in their 40s and 50s losing jobs who are not getting rehired. Our infrastructure is crumbling, as we've seen with the natural gas lines and the disaster in California. And we have a window, but we don't have the sense of urgency. Remember, Chris, when Wall Street was threatened, everybody came together, all the political establishments, and effectively said, we can't afford to have the financial system collapse. We don't exactly know how we're going to save it, but we must throw everything against the wall and save it. So I want to have the same sense of urgency about the middle class, about jobs, about foreclosure, say, we don't have all the answers. There are multiple ways to do it, but we need to do everything because we can't afford to have 26 million people out of work or underemployed and millions of people losing their homes.
Very quickly, who's the villain in the piece?
The villains are those who basically allowed themselves to be bought. Like in a banana republic, you know, the special interests are buying public policy. We had three examples. Recently, we had the Wall Street collapse, we had BP, and we had the mining disaster. They were all examples of a broken system. You know, a system where regulations don't work anymore. Remember, there were regulators at the mine the day it collapsed. There's what is known as regulatory capture.
I was just going to say, it sounds like Simon Johnson and state capture.
State capture,
yeah.
Exactly. You had, with BP, the same thing. Remember, after the last mining collapse in 06, we passed new legislation But nobody paid attention to the loopholes. You know, loopholes are like yeast. You know, you can't pass a bill without loopholes in the same way that you can't bake bread without yeast. So all these loopholes made it possible for Massey Energy to keep violating safety rules but not be closed down.
Okay, I'm just looking for a name or a handful of names or a few people. Those giant trends you're writing about don't just happen. There are people steering the boat in that direction. We thought we changed course in the Obama election, but who's to hold responsible? And then what's to do?
That's a very good point. We did think we changed course. But what I'm saying in the book is that we thought hope was going to do it, and we would elect Obama, and then we could sit back, watch television, or read the Huffington
Post. Hope was Clinton. Change was Obama, right?
Well, hope and change. It was, as Sarah Palin puts it, how is that hoppy changey thing going? And I'm saying that it's now about hope 2.0. And hope 2.0 is about what are we doing? That we can't just look to the knight on the white charger to come and save us. We have to grow up and realize that democracy is not a spectator sport. So we really need to sort of look in the mirror and discover the leader in the mirror, our own leadership potential. And that's why I end up on an optimistic note, because I believe if we do that, you know, you and I were talking backstage about Edmund Burke's Little Platoons. You know, he talked about how do you come together in communities, rebuild families, and at the same time keep being involved in movement building, in citizen action to affect what politicians are doing?
Okay, well, you mentioned a magic name, Edmund Burke, English statesman, flourished at the end of the 18th century, contemporary of Dr. Johnson and all these people. I just rediscovered Burke. Edmund Burke was William F. Buckley's great hero through the Cold War. And including the platoon stuff, which meant local government, all businesses local, and that sort of thing. We're answerable to our neighbors and our families, basically. No radical change, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Edmund Burke's really historic distinction to me was that he impeached, or he tried for years in Parliament to impeach Warren Hastings, who'd been the head of the East India Company in India, and responsible for every kind of betrayal of human rights. And Edmund Burke didn't succeed in impeaching him, but he succeeded in making Warren Hastings an evil name in human history, which indeed he was. To me, I keep asking myself this question. Where is our Edmund Burke? Where is somebody to impeach the Rumsfelds, the George W. Bushes, the Cheneys, and maybe even the Larry Summerses and the Robert Rubens, who seem to have taken over the Obama administration? That's what I'm talking about. And you mentioned Burke. I didn't realize we were on the same fan page. Edmund Burke. But Edmund Burke is, to me, the missing voice in America today. And he talked about empire. He believed in empire, but he also believed in responsible empire, empire that cared as much for Indian people and Indian prosperity and Indian welfare as they cared about English. He said it was betrayal of English rights and responsibilities that English power had so abused Indian rights.
America, in many ways, is acting like a declining empire. If you look at Afghanistan, for example, only a declining empire with a perverse sense of priorities would be spending hundreds of billions of dollars conducting a war which is unwinnable, which is not in our national security interest. Even Leon Panetta, the head of the CIA, admits that there are fewer than 100 al-Qaeda operatives in Afghanistan, and where we are basically propping up a corrupt regime. I mean, these are like military adventures that we cannot afford and that in no way are they in our interest. So that is like fascinating. You know, I quote Arnold Toynbee in the book, who said that empires more often die because they commit suicide rather than from murder.
Mm-hmm.
And you imagine what would happen if that $2 billion a week that we're spending in Afghanistan was brought here at home to help rebuild the country and get jobs for people and rebuild our infrastructure. And you mentioned Larry Summers and Rob Rubin. There's no question that the fundamental problem the Obama White House did was to appoint people whose view of the world was so Wall Street-centric to run economic policy. It was a little bit like having people, pre-Galilean people, you know, who believed that everything revolved around the Earth, produce navigation maps. Mm. You know, it wasn't going to work, right? The ships were going to sink.
I want to ask you a media question. You embody, for all of us, kind of the transformation. You've been called the most powerful blogger in the world. People are here to hear you who wouldn't believe the New York Times in a certain way. But who are we going to believe to tell us this story? Who's going to confirm in a kind of fundamental American narrative that we are at the gravest risk of being in a kind of terminal imperial moment?
Well, it's not a who. You see, that is really what is different. That's actually a very important question, because what is different is that we're not waiting for some Walter Cronkite voice to tell us this is how it is. And this is what is new and what is exciting. We all have to tell the story. We all have to tell the story of our time. And people are saying it online. So our job is to sort of collect these thousands of stories and create a mosaic.
Yeah, but may I say, I do want Walter Cronkite, in a way, to announce this. Or the gods of my youth, Walter Lippmann and James Reston and page one of the New York Times, to confirm, in a certain sense, what we all know, but in isolation. I'm still looking, this may be a bad habit, but I'm still looking for a figure that's vaguely authoritative, that's in touch with a historical narrative, kind of broader base than one, who also can write it in commanding prose, not just tell a story on a video screen, but to change the overall narrative. The overall narrative that people say is going to prevail in the elections this fall is that we're taxed too much, that the government takes our money and throws it away, or something, or that Obama's a Muslim, or that some guy in Georgia or in the South wants to burn the Quran. We are awash in these basically idiotic narratives that are fundamentally out of touch. I'm looking, in a certain sense, for the principal of the school to say, listen up, it's not that we're overtaxed, it's that we are spending
Chris,
our money in the wrong places.
Chris, okay. Let me hold your hand for a minute. This is not going to happen. Okay, get over it. There isn't going to be a Walter Cronkite to tell us how it is.
We have to grow up. His name is Glenn Beck.
But you see, it's not. Like, that's the point. Glenn Beck and the Tea Party movement is responding to the incredible abuse of power by our establishments. Now, their response is potentially dangerous, but there is a lot of legitimate anger right there.
I agree.
I mean, if I were out of work, if I had lost everything, how would I feel? And I'm pretty angry, and I still have a job, but I'm pretty angry about the fact that we bailed out with taxpayer money the same people who wrecked our economy without any strings attached, without any conditions. I can understand that we had to bail them out, but I would have put stringent conditions, clawbacks for the people that they had basically stolen the money from in their own exotic ways. No bonuses. Having to lend back to the community. Ending too big to fail. All these things that didn't happen. So that anger, if you scratch the surface of whatever the Tea Partiers are saying, underneath it is this incredible anger at the bailout. So right now, there are going to be sort of two forces. It's going to be the Tea Party response, which very often becomes anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, basically scapegoating, which has been a response that we've seen throughout history. Mm-hmm. And then there can be a constructive response, which is, yes, the system is screwed up. We need to try and fix the system. While we're fixing it, we need to see what can we do in our own communities, with our own families, to turn things around. If we don't do that, we are basically ceding the future to the forces of anger that are really creating, as you said, these idiotic narratives to make sense of what has happened in their lives.
I just want to mention another take on the same phenomenon that I read in Truth Dig when I wasn't reading HuffPo this morning. It was a Chris Hedges piece that really kind of shook me because it's almost what I believe. And a lot of it came from Ralph Nader. But the lead on the piece was that it's almost impossible to point at any big institution in this country now, including Congress and the unions and media even, and feel a kind of democratic voice, to know that there is a kind of venting of genuine, authentic experience. They're talking, and this again is Ralph, I've heard it from Chris Hedges too before, but that the problem is a kind of a corporate strangulation of almost everything. They bought everything now. And I wonder if we don't, as they do, have to sort of name an enemy before we're going to beat it.
Well, first of all, I don't think they've bought everything. I think I have an entire section which is about amazing acts of resilience, creativity, compassion all around the country that would move you to tears. And there is a lot of that that's happening. And that's why I'm saying it depends on what you focus. You know, you can focus on what is dying. You can focus on what is being born. And really, I'm encouraging you to do both. You know, we have to focus on the acts of destruction and all that's happening that potentially can turn us into a third world America. We can't close our eyes to that. But we also need to focus and put the spotlight, and that's my commitment on the Huffington Post, to all the incredible acts of creativity, innovation, and empathy. Because by doing that, we're inspiring others to do the same. And it's almost like a muscle. The more we exercise it, the stronger it gets.
Ariana, may I ask you a last question?
Of course, you're in charge.
There are two disconnects that we haven't addressed. One is this tremendous loss of traction of the hopes around Barack Obama. And to me, there's a sort of parallel question about media. We've democratized media from the bottom up. Thousands of people can write for your wonderful blog, including me, and I'm privileged to be able to do it. But it's a privilege that all sorts of people can have. And in general, you can be your own broadcaster, as I am. You can be your own publisher, as she is, with a little wit and hard application. But we haven't changed the story. Glenn Beck, who we think is a lunatic, is telling the story that even the New York Times takes as its lead now. What's missing in both of these transformations? The promise of change in the White House that I think the country really wanted, and the transformation of bottom-up voices in place of the old media.
Well, I think part of it is that historically, and you're a student of history, you realize that fundamental reform that challenges the status quo always is harder and takes longer than we think, inevitably, without question. You know, my favorite story that I have in the book is Martin Luther King meeting with Lyndon Johnson in March 65 and asking for the Voting Rights Act, and Lyndon Johnson saying, "We don't have the votes," which is what they always say. And then came the Selma March, and a few months later we had the Voting Rights Act. So citizens have to just continue working hard to make real transformative change happen. And we saw that it's not enough to just elect somebody like Barack Obama. The movement has to continue building and demanding change. And it's almost like, you know, politicians put their, even the best ones, put their finger and see which way the wind is blowing. So we have to change the way the wind is blowing. And you said, you asked one other thing about the media. So,
well, yeah, I'm still a big believer in transformation of media by opening up the conversation.
Yes.
And yet it seems in a certain way to be stuck. Maybe one way to ask it, I was thinking about to ask it to you, what is the difference now and in the future, but even now, between, you know, this is your nation on the Huffington Post, and this is your nation on the old mainstream media.
And I can tell you.
What's changed, and what bigger change can we hope for?
First of all, there is a lot of bigger change coming. Secondly, I think the key difference is that if mainstream media suffer from ADD, you know, attention deficit disorder, you know, they break a lot of important stories and then they move on. And that means that we don't have enough time to process it all and bring about real change. You know, it doesn't have enough time to have real impact. Online media suffer from OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. Like, we take a story and we stay on it, and we stay on it, and we stay. I mean, like, look at, if you go on the Huffington Post now, you will just not be able to escape third world America. Stories of success, stories of struggle. It takes time to build, and we recognize that on any story that we cover. When we covered the mining disaster, we stayed on the story, and even after you could no longer read anything about that story in the mainstream media because they were done with it. You know, it's like, we did that. We stayed on the story. I mean, like, BP has practically disappeared from the mainstream media, but we're staying on the story about what's happening. So that is really the hope. We can't just lose interest and just move on to the next big story. And that is ultimately going to be the way you can build the kind of media that can have the impact that we want and bring about real change.
Arianna Huffington, thank you, and thanks to a wonderful audience too.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.